Radio.
Pub Theology is a monthly get-together held at the Dan O'Connell Hotel in North Adelaide. 20-somethings meet up to hear engaging speakers give straight talk, hard facts, and real answers on the Catholic faith. Right now, you're listening to the best of Pub Theology on cradio.org.au.
When Michael sort of mentioned to us to think of a topic to talk about, I'm a healthcare ethicist, and Anna has worked in healthcare ethics as well, and long experience of that, especially here in Adelaide in the Southern Cross Bioethics Institute. One of the areas that we were thinking of was to do with euthanasia. It could have been to do with abortion. It could have been to do with a whole range of areas. But we presented to Michael something a little bit unusual, a little bit different. And the notion of what is this thing called the new feminism is what we wanted to present at. We lecture in healthcare ethics to nurses and midwives in Melbourne, and this is an area of feminism in Catholic Church. You would think the two don't go together, that the word feminism and Catholic, it's not going to happen. But John Paul II in the 1990s, came out with some amazing writing, especially for women, that started presenting the sense of the new feminism and challenging, you could argue, some of the secular notions of feminism. So how are we going to split this up tonight? And Anna and I have got some notes for you to take away afterwards. Michael's printed some off for us, which was very kind. So we've got about 100 copies, so you don't need to take any notes. You can, if you didn't want to. So how we're going to do this is I'm going to introduce what is the notion of feminism from a secular perspective and give you some examples of contemporary issues that are happening in especially the Western feminism. And then Anna's going to take that and present it in a different way and present it in with relation to John Paul II and the Catholic Church's teachings on the genius of woman. And as I said to Michael, it's just fantastic to see so many men here. This is great. Because men and women in feminism is often being presented as being in opposites to each other, as being there's been a conflict. And what Anna is going to look at is explore that and give you a whole different understanding of this notion of feminism and the new feminism according to the Church's teachings. So I'm going to start off with secular feminism, give you a little bit of a history about that. And the first thing to say, it's complex. There are many, many forms of feminism. And to be here, I could give you this talk that could last for hours just on this part. So I know there's probably many of you here who actually might know this topic much better than me. And you might think, oh, she's missed this, or she could have missed this, or, you know, that wasn't covered. I'm going to give you Feminism 101 or Feminism for Dummies, you know, over a period of about 15 minutes. And so please, if you want to take these notes away, you can actually get some further insights and do some of your own. We've got some suggested readings. In 1913, Rebecca West, who is a journalist and a campaigner for the political and social rights of women, was asked about why does she do what she's doing. And she said, look, I myself have never been able to find precisely a definition of what feminism is. I only know that people call me a feminist whenever I express sentiments that differentiate me from a doormat and a prostitute. Now, feminism itself is an academic theory, and it explores the inherent understandings of how sex or gender distorts our thinking. And such distortions can be particularly harmful for girls, for women, but also for men. And it's something really important to note that feminist theories, I know quite a few feminist theorists who are men. I know quite a few feminist papers that are written about men and gender inequality and problems there as well. So it's not just about women's issues. I think there's a view that feminism is about women speaking about women's issues. That's not correct. Now, a very prominent US feminist ethicist, Professor Maggie Little, and if you Google her name, Professor, she's from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and she's probably one of the most well-known feminist ethicists for me in healthcare, my particular area. And she's given this definition, which I think is quite a good one. She says that a feminist theory can be, it's an attempt to uncover the ways in which conceptions of gender distort people's views of the world and to articulate the ways in which these distortions, which are hurtful to all. So she just doesn't say they're hurtful to women. She says they're actually hurtful to both male and females, and which are hurtful to all, but they are particularly constraining to women. And one of the examples that Little gives, I was in Georgetown for 2 months last year doing some work with Maggie Little, and one of the examples that she gives is in relation to healthcare research. So those of you who are from a healthcare background may have read some of these studies. In healthcare research, well, she was on the National Health Board of the US, which is like our NHMRC here, National Health Medical Research Council, and she was one of the key ethicists on that national board. And she questioned a study that was being done about a decade or so ago that was looking at the impact of certain drugs on mental illness. And this particular drug was being trialled and the impact it had upon depression. And when she looked at the study, she said, there are no women in this study. And the comment that was made by the researchers was, well, women's hormones, they get in the way of the data. There's too much fluctuations in a woman's hormone cycles to actually give accurate representation of data. And she said, well, isn't that the reason why it should be done on women, to actually understand that? And in fact, they found out that the actual drug that they were looking at needed to be given in different doses in a woman's menstrual cycle because of hormone factors. And her argument was that you can't just get rid of one part of the, you know, one classification, one group of persons just because they muck up data, or supposedly. And so she argues in this sense of this feminist theory that when we have a look at the way that the gender is distorted in society, we need to look at ways that we can actually address that. And feminism has been around for about 300 years. It's not something that's just happened in the 1960s. You'll hear that the thought that feminism has only been since the movement of the 60s. That's not correct. In fact, feminism came from the liberal philosophy, which was saying that wanting for equal rights for women. And again, as I mentioned before, there are different forms of feminism. A very well-known author in this area is a woman named Alison Jager. And she wrote a book called Feminist Politics and Human Nature. And she classifies four different types of feminism. We have liberal feminism, Marxist feminism, radical feminism, and also a socialist feminism. And I'm just going to give a brief description of each, because it'll actually tie into some of the stuff that Anna's also going to be bringing up. So liberal feminism argues that women should have the same social equalities as men, to be free to pursue their own interests, to compete for social and economic positions for power, and not to be judged on gender. Now, that sounds reasonable. There's lots of... One of the things to present to you tonight is that feminism is not necessarily a thought, a construct that is something to be put on the side as a Catholic. In fact, a lot of the Catholic social teachings would actually support the notion of women with equal rights, with equal freedoms. A Marxist feminism locates the oppression of women in a class society and under capitalism. So to be actually be free of that in a Marxist feminism says that the elimination of the traditional family unit should happen, which is quite interesting. And also that women are to be incorporated fully into the public realm of production, to be workers. Now, radical feminism, which is what you probably know the most or have heard the most about, radical feminism locates women's oppression in sex gender systems, under particularly a patriarchal system. And one of the key focuses of radical feminism is to ensure that women are liberated from childbirth, from marriage. It's one of the key focuses of a radical feminism. And socialist feminism has a combination of radical and Marxist feminism, so that puts the two of them together. Now, why is that important? One of the arguments that I've always made about feminism is that I believe it's a Western construct. It is something that is very prominent in Western cultures, But if you take it to a culture that isn't a Western culture, it can be quite problematic. And interesting, there's some studies to prove this. There is an Asian philosopher named Anthony Fung who has written a paper on this saying, look, you know, feminist philosophy may have flourished in Western cultures, but if you bring it to an Eastern culture, it's quite problematic. He actually says that when transplanted into a foreign context, however, there is no guarantee that the feminist movement will develop in the same way, the same forms and the same processes. And in his paper, he talks about, of interest, he says, look, you know, when you look at, say, somewhere like Thailand, you could argue that there's a really strong Marxist feminism because 80% of women work in Thailand. But then he goes on and points out that a large percentage of those workers are in the sex trade. So he said, look, you know, you've got to put it into perspective. And he says, in fact, he believes that feminism is purely a Western construct. And when you start trying to move it into the Eastern frameworks, it's problematic. And he says that feminism does exist in these cultures, but at a really basic level. And he says the basic level is trying to have the minimum standards of living for women, not trying to have them emancipatory in political activities and all those. It's actually just getting your basic survival of women in those countries. So when we look at feminism, you'll hear the terms wave, waves of feminism. And there are three types of waves, what's known. There's the first wave. Now, the first wave refers to around about the 1900s to the late 70s. So you think of the push for the right of women to vote as an example, what we call suffragettes. You'll hear that term. And looking at the social and legal equalities for women, that's in the first wave. The second wave of feminism is one that you wouldn't know the most, I would think. And that second wave of feminism is the one that is quite famous to do with reproductive rights and fertility and choice. And it came about roughly about 1953, roughly. It's precisely 1953. The catalyst for the second wave of the feminist movement was a book by a very famous woman called Simone de Beauvoir called The Second Sex, where a French existentialist writer, philosopher from the University of Paris in the Sorbonne, she wrote a book called The Second Sex, where she argued that women are viewed as the other to men. They're not viewed as equal. And in that book, it's a very long book. You can actually get it online. You can read the whole thing online. She has a very famous quote in that book where she says that pregnancy is a biological tyranny for women. She actually uses that phrase, biological tyranny. So for a woman to be pregnant, to be married, is actually to limit a woman's freedom. Her book was a catalyst for the second wave of feminism. We have, and the other sort of visual, you may have seen it in the media the last couple of weeks actually. In World War II, there was a famous image of a woman who was seen to be, has been used by the feminist movement in the last 20, 30 years, in particular, Rosie the Riveter. Has anyone heard of that image? And it's a very famous image of a woman who, during World War II, was working in the ammunition factory in America. And she's dressed in overalls and she's looking like a worker, like something from even like a communist sort of state. But she's got her arm up like this and she's going, I'm woman and I'm strong and I'm doing this. That was actually an image that was generated by this second wave of feminism. And interesting, she died only 3 weeks ago. And there was these odes to Rosie the Riveter and who she actually was and how she represented this generation of feminists. So for those of you who are old enough, there might be a few here, you know, famous Australian. I think she was actually South Australian, wasn't she, Helen Reddy? Maybe I'm wrong. I thought she was. Famous Australian woman who wrote a song called I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar. That became the catch cry of the feminist movement in the 70s. Now, the third wave of feminism is one that I think maybe this generation, especially of young women, may know a little bit more about. And it actually rose as a response to the second wave. And in the third wave of feminism, it's where the central issues are of race, social class and sexuality. It's not just focusing on women, it's focusing on both men and women. And a strong focus of that is relationships, relationality between men and women. and also between culture and society and its impact upon gender. Now, this third wave of feminists are often, you know, they're roughly in their 30s, late 30s, and have a very different thought to their second wave mothers or godmothers or who were the second wave feminists. And in fact, there's a US, very famous US third wave feminist called Rebecca Walker, and her godmother is the prominent second wave feminist, Gloria Steinem. And she said this quote, she said, "Young women feminists find themselves wanting their speech and tone, watching their speech and tone in their works, so not as to upset their older feminist mothers or godmothers in this case." She says there is a definite gap among feminists who consider themselves to be a second wave and those who would label themselves as the third wave of feminism. Although the age criteria for the second wave feminists and third wave feminists is murky, younger feminists definitely have a hard time proving themselves worthy as feminist scholars and activists. This term new feminism, which is associated with the third wave, which is what Anna's going to be looking at and exploring a bit more to do with the Catholic culture and Catholic context, was coined by a young British feminist writer named Natasha Walker, and she wrote a book in 1998 called The New Feminism. And what she was doing with this book is that she was saying, you know, if you're going to be a feminist, these are the things that you should focus on. And people like Germaine Greer, Gloria Steinem, and quite a few of the more traditional radical feminists came out against this young lady and said, you're not even a feminist. You're actually what they use, lifestyle feminist is what they called her. And they actually attacked her. And they were sort of, it was like this horizontal violence between women about the same ideas of feminism. And Germaine Greer actually said, well, we can't have these young girls coming up undoing everything that we've done in the 60s and 70s and the 80s. So Germaine Greer, who is an Australian again, who wrote a really famous book called The Female Eunuch, is what is known as the Feminist Manifesto, said, I've got to write another book. And she actually wrote a book called The New Woman as a response to Walker and her company of these third waves saying, hang on, we're still the feminists, you're just the babies learning. And this is the true notion of feminism. And in responding to that, Walker said, hang on, we're all trying to do the same thing. We're all trying to support women, to feminist theories, society and culture. And she says, you're not being very sisterly. And she actually used that term, you're not being very sisterly. And that didn't go down very well with Greer. She wrote another big letter to Walker on that one. Now, in her recent book, Walker, this British feminist, she's got a recent book called Living Dolls, The Return of Sexism. And what Walker is saying is that there is now an impact upon culture of women where supposedly there's liberating choices for women and saying that it's empowering women to make these choices when she actually argues they're sexist. And she's arguing that the emancipation of women is taking all these steps back with contemporary Western culture. And she uses the term raunch culture, which some of you may have heard of. And she cites things such as the increase in women accessing cosmetic surgery and self-expression in things like pole dancing and, you know, wanting to be like the famous video clips and a whole range of things as, you know, women saying that they want to be sexual beings and being expressive with this. And from this third wave feminist movement, they're actually saying, what are you doing? There could be something wrong with that, something inherently wrong with that. And she actually called that it was totally wrong of her to think that feminism can actually be something where a woman who expresses herself this self-expression in sexuality to take it to that level. She's arguing, actually, we're not doing the right thing by feminism here. And she says, this creeping silence on feminism matters, particularly for younger women who did not even experience the third wave, let alone the second wave of feminism. She says, at the moment, young women are being sold personal rather than political empowerment. And young women are under the constant blandishments of a culture that tells them that the only way to feel empowered is through shopping and plastic surgery. she's written in this book, Living Dolls, The Return of Sexism. This was supported by an American feminist writer named Ariel Levy, who also wrote a book called Female Chauvinist Pigs, The Rise of the Raunch Culture. A very controversial text when this one came out. In this text, she actually argues that Western culture, in particular American culture, is so heavily saturated with explicit sexual references and objectification of women, particularly from pornography, that such an obsession with sex has resulted in women being encouraged to sexually objectify themselves. And in this book, she has a term what she calls lipstick feminists. And it's interesting because I've actually seen an article from Levy where she actually questions that to Sarah Palin, saying that Palin, she argues, is a lipstick feminist. And she says that these lipstick feminists are presenting that things such as pole dancing and stripping and all these things are meant to be empowering, and putting on a show for men is empowering for women. And she says, in fact, it's disempowering for women. And in the same book, she even talks about how the push for women to break the glass ceiling all the time, the constant push to break this glass ceiling in business and a whole range of things. She said, what's the point of pushing that as an objective for women, to break the glass ceiling? Because once you break it, you're still the same as the person who's got the job. You're there because you're good for the job, not because you're a woman. Is that not the case? Should we be celebrating the fact that a woman could get a job in a high position, not because she's a woman, but because she's actually best for the job? And I remember when Gillard was first made Prime Minister, she assumed the role, but when she assumed the role, one of the comments that she said was, I'm the best person for the job. Whether or not I'm the woman for the job is irrelevant. And a lot of the second wave feminists supported her in that. So we actually had Australian feminist writer Eva Cox in particular coming out saying, you know, well, you know, yes, she is a woman, she's the best person in the world, but how great is it for Australia? So in Australia, some of the work undertaken by grassroots campaigns such as Collective Shout, you may have heard of Collective Shout. Collective Shout works against the sexual exploitation of women and girls in particular in contemporary culture through advertising and media outlets. That could be an example of this third wave new feminism where we're looking at the impact upon culture, upon women. And Collective Shout, I know, has a lot to do with... They're quite powerful in their work. I know they Rivers had a campaign a couple of months ago, Anna, wasn't it? About 2-3 months ago, Rivers had a campaign where they were selling shoes, and the image on the front of their magazine to sell the shoes was of a woman in fishnet stockings with high heel shoes stuck under a couch, supposedly dead. And the comment was, you will die for these bargains. And Collective Shout presented to Rivers, you know, what are you doing? What's the purpose of that image of having a woman in a sexually explicit gear selling shoes, supposedly dead under a couch? What's the purpose of that? And they set up a campaign against it and saying, look, you know, you're objectifying women in your media in what you're doing for this. And it was hysterical because the next catalogue they had was this grumpy, sour-faced old woman, like really, really, and she's just sitting there going, I can't remember, but it said something along the lines of, want a bargain? I've got it. So what Rivers did is they said, well, if we can't do that, we're going to go on the opposite extreme. So a friend of ours, Anna and I, who founded Collective Shout, said, well, at least they took notice. You know, the fact that they actually changed their campaign by what we were saying is a good thing, that they actually saw that what they were doing was objectifying women in media. And this was not on, just to sell a pair of shoes from Rivers, which is $22 anyway. Now, we're not talking about Jimmy Choo's here. We're talking about Rivers. Come on. But it was interesting to think that was the case. I'm going to close off with my area so you can hear a bit more about Anna. But some of the... I've put on this list for you to have a look at some of the contemporary issues in feminism in to do with health and social and society and culture at the moment. Music clips featuring certain artists at the moment. I mean, Lady Gaga's in town. You only have to look at some of those, or hopefully not look at too hard, some of those film clips to see a lot of S&M bondage, a lot of sexual explicit language and terms. Like there was one with Rhiannon who was in, the film clip was a simulation of a rape of a woman, a whole range of, and that was just in a media clip, that a music clip that happens at 10:30 in the morning on Saturday morning TV. For girls and men to see. We've also got an increased rise in cosmetic surgery for young women and reconstructive surgery for young women. And I'm a nurse, and so I'm probably used to saying these sort of phrases, but, and so hopefully it's not too graphic, but there is a, you have in Africa a big push by the Western feminists saying that African women shouldn't have a cultural practice called female genital mutilation. And then you have in Western cultures, women, young girls, 400% increase in the last 4 years of young Australian girls choosing to have what we call labiaplasties relating to pornography and culture, and it's classified as being their choice, when in another culture in Africa it's classified as being an oppression to women. The difference between one is one's a Western ethic and one's a cultural ethic. And I argue that they're exactly the same harm to women, grounded in culture. We have the Toddlers and Tiara pageant in Melbourne a week ago. You may have seen the media about that, where young girls are dressed up to look like that they're 25, 30-year-old models walking down a catwalk and they're only five. We have Botox for five-year-olds who are in those pageants, where mothers are actually taught by the doctors to give Botox to their five-year-old girls to relieve, you know how cute little five-year-old kids are, you know, they've got the little chubby face. Well, they've got creases because they've got chubbies, you know. That's part and parcel of the cute, the, who these kids are. This mother in the US was actually charged with harm against her daughter for injecting her with Botox. We have pornification, the term pornification of tweens. So tweens is the between 8 and 12 years of age of girls, and the type of clothing that certain companies like Cotton On Clothing have very explicit statements on T-shirts for those girls. There was a series of, they had some underwear for children who were at 5 years of age that said on some of the underwear for girls, "Bite me." And this is the sort of thing that the groups like Collective Shout are trying to do in saying, look, it's not only harmful for young girls, it's also harmful for men and for the culture and for women. It's not just harmful for just one gender, it's harmful for the whole society. And finally, I can't help but present the notion of, and where I see there's a bit of a conflict at the moment in my own studies in healthcare ethics, the reproductive rights in the desire to choose the gender of a child, male or female child, through the desire, well, I want to support my or my dream of my family. I've got two boys, I want a girl, so I go and choose my gender. And there's a push by feminists in Western culture to say, yeah, you know, it's a woman's reproductive right to choose this. So therefore, the second wave feminists in particular are saying, let's give the right to these women. Yet those same feminists say nothing about the fact that in India and in China, the gendercide of young girls, and especially female unborn babies, is 5 to 1. So for every one male baby born, they argue that in those countries, you know, they have a more significant portion that are aborted, and they're all female babies because of caste system, because of dowries, because of a whole range of things. The same feminists aren't saying anything about that. So there's a real conflict there. So that's just a little bit of an overview of some of the notions of feminism from a secular perspective, and what some of the grassroots campaigns are, and what some of the conflicts are, because there are conflicts in feminism. And as Anna and I both classify ourselves in the new feminism mode of John Paul II, that's how we're passionate. We're passionate about John Paul. We're passionate about the church. We're passionate about women and women's role in the church. I think you're going to find what Anna has to present on this notion is something that might be new to you. And if you've got sisters, which I'm sure a lot of you have, you might want to actually pass on this message to them, that to be a woman in the church is not to actually say we're being oppressed, as some would present, but it's actually to say we have something of equal value to contribute, and in something that it's actually been destined for us as women, something very unique, something very special, something very beautiful. And John Paul tapped into it. So I'll hand over to Anna.
Thank you, Jo. You probably wondered after all that, there's so many waves of feminism, you're probably wondering whether the word feminism actually means anything at all. In fact, that's, I think, quite a lot of young women that I meet these days actually not very interested in the topic of feminism, because it actually has become so fraught. There are so many different philosophical positions, you don't actually know what it means. And I think Jo's pointed out how many confusing waves there are and how contradictory it must seem to anyone who probably has asked themselves the question, does it actually mean anything at all? I think there's also one third issue, and that is that the various waves of trying to work for women have often become besieged by what essentially are secular philosophies. So they've had the same weaknesses that those secular philosophies have had about the human person. So, for instance, a Marxist feminist is somebody who struggles, who says, you know, there's a class struggle between the workers and the form of production and so on. Translating that struggle into the relationship between men and women doesn't necessarily illuminate the issue. And I guess when we have question time, very happy to talk about some of those sort of philosophical problems that I think have meant a lot of people have turned off the issue. Am I right about that? If I say the word feminism, what reaction do most of you, because you're all a generation or more younger than me, if I say the word feminism, just give me your one response back. Feminism.
Boring.
Yep. Anyone else? The sort of power struggle, feminazis. What's another reaction? Yep. Anyone over here?
Sexism.
Reverse sexism. What about women? Can I hear some women's voices here? Isn't it interesting? There's no women's voices. Oh, boring was one. Any more women? Women? Yes, tuned out. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because this was like an issue that everybody assumed in the 1960s. Most women just assumed that everyone was meant to be a feminist, and many of the institutions that you work in are based on feminist philosophies. But in fact, nobody really has a very clear idea of what it means anymore. And I think that's a result of some of the things that Jo's been describing, the wave after wave of different interpretations of feminism, and the fact that people actually don't find it that interesting. Although, isn't it interesting, so many people are here to hear about it. So obviously there's some questions there that are important to interpret. Can a Christian be a feminist? I'm going to try it again on audience response.
Yes.
A lot of I got two people said that we're, what about the blokes? Can it,
yes.
You reckon? Don't be politically correct, just say what you think. Okay. Well, what I've been asked to do for the talk is just really to look at what that word might mean. Is there any meaning in the word feminist that's useful? And secondly, is it compatible with a Christian anthropology, that is, a Christian view of the human person? And I want to try and talk about this in the light of the huge contribution that Pope John Paul II made to our understanding of the human person and the way in which we can communicate that to the world today. After all, he would say, this is essential to the communication of the gospel to the world. In other words, what we have to say about the relationship between men and women, about the natures of men and women, about the way they relate to each other, about the things that they aspire to, that's a big part of John Paul's message, is what is it in people's hearts? I think when I was last in this pub, I spoke on the theology of the body. And I tried a question out on the audience, which I've tried at schools. And I'm going to try it again. How many people here do not want to find true love? And I'm going to give you, you can have any reference, an open book exam. You're allowed to use any books you like, and you can have however long you need to answer that question. How many people here don't want to find true love? Hands up, please. You don't want to find true love.
Not yet.
Not yet. Well, no, hang on. You want your mum? Do you want your mum to love you? Yeah. I think you probably, when you think about it, you think about that gooey kind of true love, don't you? Yeah. But by and large, almost everybody knows that the starting point for their aspirations is to find true love. True, truthful, and real love. And the same thing, I think, applies in the question about whether I want to be a real, fulfilled, happy man or happy woman. The questions are the same, but the way we find them is somewhat different. So the point I'm making is that John Paul's teaching about the human person has a much to say, because it's really the gospel translated using his particular philosophical skills and language. So was John Paul a feminist? Let's start with that question, now that we've all canvassed whether we think that's interesting or not. John Paul II said to a famous conference that was a UN conference that took place on the Fourth World Conference on Women, which was a very controversial one, where many of the women who called themselves feminists said no Christian can be a feminist because Christianity of itself betrays women. That was the ideology of that conference. And that the Christian view of the family, of marriage, of children, of the unborn was deeply incompatible with the rights of women. That was, so you can imagine being a Christian going into that conference. What would it have been like knowing that you had not just uninterested people, you had openly, ideologically hostile people facing you? In other words, ones which say being a Christian is totally incompatible with the rights and liberation of women. So into this marches John Paul, who was never scared of a confrontation, and says to the women of that conference that he agreed that in many ways women have been disadvantaged through history, either because they are made visible not for who they really are, their uniqueness, in the way that men are often recognised for their uniqueness, but because they exist as a type of symbol for men's aspirations, their lusts, their self-aggrandisement. Or on the other hand, women have been invisible. Invisible because their world, their culture, their activities has been relegated to the private, the unimportant, the trivial. John Paul says that's not Christian. And it's never been the Christian view that women should A, be just a symbol, abstract, not real, or B, that they should be invisible. That is not Christian teaching. So that's pretty much putting the gauntlet down, isn't it? So saying, in other words, to be a true Christian, we neither accept that women are just symbols or that they should be silent until spoken to, invisible. Our culture today really does those two things. We pretend that it's about individuality, but my argument is that secular versions of what women should be either make them more exaggerated symbols or actually silence them. A talk that Joe and I are giving tomorrow is about the effects of abortion on women. And we're going to say that the political correctness surrounding abortion has effectively silenced women and men. Men are totally silenced. You're not even allowed to open your mouth on this issue, a fundamental human rights issue that you are not allowed to say anything about. And women who may have experienced the fallout from abortion are also silenced. So now we have a greater invisibility and a greater caricature. Why is that? Well, John Paul says there's a number of reasons why this is. And basically, I want to talk about the ways in which, very quickly, he argues that men and women are radically equal. Radically equal in the Christian teaching, but not the same. Radically equal, but not the same. So his first point is that men and women are different. Duh. Have we noticed this? But I think we notice it, but we don't quite believe it. The book that Joe mentioned is the one on the living dolls. I think that, in fact, in Western culture today, we actually think that men and women are Ken and Barbie, don't we? Ken and Barbie. They look different. They've got plastic modular shapes, but on the inside, they're just air. It's all about the way you look on the outside. Christian view of the person is that we are informed from the inside out. In fact, the most important part of ourselves is the mystery of who we are, our souls, the part of ourselves that nobody can... We can see glimpses of the soul. You know, we say the eye is the window to the soul. In fact, we're bigger... I think I said this once before. We're bigger on the inside than we are on the outside. So our truth... Some people have heard me say this before. But our truth is greater on the inside than it is even on our appearances or our way we dress. They're not insignificant, but the most important thing about us is the essence of who we are. Our culture has lost any confidence in talking about this. Do you agree? So basically men and women are more or less the same kind of dolls, Ken or Barbie. You just dress up the outside. But the trouble with Ken and Barbie is if you cut into them, they're empty on the inside. And secondly, when you put them into a pot and melt them, they're just plastic. In other words, exchangeable for each other. You can melt down Ken and make Barbie. Very strange idea. They'll probably make a series out of it. What am I doing? The Christian view of the person is that right down to our roots, and this is particularly clear in John Paul II's teaching, we are distinct. We're distinct in several ways. First is who we are as individuals. There's never going to be another person just like you. Anyone here an identical twin? Anyone an identical twin? In other words, you're basically genetically almost a copy, not quite, because we continue to, anyone who does science knows that we mutate gradually and all the time. But identical twins are almost carbon copies of each other. Are they the same person? No. There's no Ken and Barbie going on there. They're distinctly themselves, never to be repeated, ever, 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 ever in history. That's the first thing. So important. So even before we ask whether someone's a man or woman, we say, who are you? What's your name? Unique. Second layer of distinction that is very essential to who we are is whether we are male or female. That seems to be something that if I were to describe you walking down the street and a person broke into the house, this person was 6'3" or whatever it is in metric, they had blonde hair and they walked out. What's an essential piece of information I need to kind of work out who did it? Anyone who watches Spooks or any of those other detective series? Whether they're a man or a woman, it seems to be quite important, doesn't it? Detective doesn't know who they're really looking for. Could be a cat burglar of any shape or size, but we really need to know whether that person's a man or woman. Now, John Paul says that, in fact, science is actually supporting this. Men and women are chromosomally different. They're genetically different. The way those genes work in a person form different ways of our brains being shaped. This is all we're starting to know much, much more about how different we are. Different but not predictably different in some cases. So the way we feel on the inside about being a man or woman is because we have different bodies. And for John Paul, the difference of bodies is part of the way God made us. God is revealing something about his relational being as the Trinity by having a sexed universe. It's a blessing, although sometimes it doesn't feel like it. Okay, so what are some of the things John Paul draws from this? First of all, that every human being has dignity, inherently. Secular feminisms often don't acknowledge this. They say your dignity is if you have power or recognition or the vote, equal opportunities. They're all important aspects of recognising dignity, but for Christians, dignity is just by being a member of the human family, just because you're uniquely who you are. And John Paul says, and this includes the pre-born, the elderly, the disabled. Essential to the dignity of each of those people. And John Paul says women have an essential role to play because they teach us first how to care authentically for a human person, because they care for their own children in this way. Ironically, he says that in an age where women and men are pressured to eliminate their children on the basis of those very qualities of difference that we just spoke about, disability and so on. Secondly, thirdly, I think I'm up to now, he says that, John Paul says that each man and woman have different ways of contributing to their vocations, and he calls what women have, adopting a word of a famous Catholic writer called Edith Stein, she became Sister Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, who died in Auschwitz, a Jewish Catholic saint now. She said, he says that women and men have their different kind of genius. You didn't know that, did you? You didn't know you had a genius? But you do have a genius. And that means a quality of fulfilling yourself and others that's uniquely shaped according to whether you're a man or a woman. And he argues, John Paul argues, that women have such an important role to play in making our world more humane. Now, I think traditionally people did recognise that. Did you ever hear maybe your grandparents say something needed a woman's touch or a woman's eye? Woman's touch, that's quite often said. You know, if you, men who'd been out at sea for a long time say, it wasn't just physical touch, but something about the way women care or notice each other, or look, anyone who lives in a religious house, Father Marnes, probably knows what that means, that there's something essentially needed in the life, even of a spiritual life, which recognises the contribution of women. In, we're very lucky in the Catholic Church that there's always this feminine presence. And who's that? Our Lady, Mother of... She's essential to Orthodox and Catholic belief. She's a presence. I think it was Kenneth Clark who said after some, you know, in certain stages in history, the feminine was removed from culture entirely and replaced by a kind of utilitarianism, a functionalism, which was inhumane. So the feminine genius, what is it made up of? He said women have a number of capacities, which he doesn't make into stereotypes. He talks about them as a dynamic. So they'll look different from each woman. One woman might wear trousers and go out into the jungle. She's still using her feminine genius because she's looking after the poor or something. Another woman might be at home looking after her children. Another woman might be a ballet dancer. They don't look the same, but they are using something of their feminine genius. Let me give you quickly what he thinks are some of the points that are part of the feminine genius. And you can ask me some questions in question time. I've also written about this, so I'm happy to give you an article on this if you'd like to. First of all, using the scriptures, John Paul says, women are made to be companions with men, co-workers. And he uses the early book in Genesis, the earliest creation story in Genesis, where the creation of Eve is to make a helpmate, is the word, helpmate in the Hebrew. Do you notice it doesn't say housemaid? You notice it doesn't say servant as such? It doesn't say lap dancer? Doesn't say object, helpmate. The first two human beings in the Genesis story are complementary, male and female. So women have a particular role to play as companions. Obviously, in a spousal relationship, that takes on a particular sacramental form. But even in your in workplace, in the church, think of the great movements in the church. All the great movements, apart from maybe the Jesuits. I was thinking about this, but all of them have had... That's not true, because Mary Ward could be almost counted as a complement to the way the great St. Ignatius formed the movement. But all of the great saints seem to have worked in this complementary way. Have a think about it. St. Francis, St. Clair, even John Paul II and Mother Teresa are sharing the two ways of being human in building up the holiness of the church. Second one is that women play a prophetic role. Think of the women in Northern Ireland who brokered for peace. Women are quite often doing that. How many of you have had family fights where mum comes in and brokers for peace quite often? She has to put herself in between you. Women, one of the roles that women have, it seems, is to step outside and go, the dynamic's all wrong here. Sort it. How often does, and in a way that dad stands outside and goes, I can't stand this fight, whereas mum goes, no, come on, you two. Because women have this ability quite often to see how relationships can go wrong. Thirdly, women are artists. When we talked about the women's touch, John Paul talks about women creating environs. So women often will come in and say, well, that's not right, let's sort that out. Let's make that person feel more at home. Let's do this. So feminine genius, in very broad brushstrokes, women seem to have some of these qualities. It's not stereotypical, but it's general. And lastly, what do women do? They're life givers. And the term that John Paul says is inherent in every woman is her maternity. Now, feminists get really, really ropeable when they hear John Paul say this. They say, what? I'm defined by my motherhood? And he says, well, men are defined by the potential for fatherhood. If you really want to think about what that means, it has a spiritual and a psychological meaning, not necessarily that you will be a biological father or a biological mother, but that something essential to who we are is tied up in these two dynamics, being either maternal or paternal. It's interesting that in the church we follow that through, don't we? We say when a priest takes on the role of caring for his flock, call him father. Or a reverend mother is often mother or sister. The head of a Benedictine community, since Anthony started with the Benedictines, is an abbot. What does that mean? Abba, father. So essential to every vocation, whether you're a celibate or a married person, is one of these geniuses of either paternity or maternity. Are you with me so far? Is that okay? We talked about complementarity. John Paul says one of the biggest mistakes in the feminist debate is it became a power struggle, and that many of the forms of feminism that Joe mentioned simply end up being like a wrestle for power. And quite often, she talked about the third level feminists coming in and being wrestled to the ground because it became about power and nothing else. But John Paul says the real message of feminism is what St. Paul calls in his letter to the Ephesians, mutual submission. That is service of the other. I serve you and you serve me. That I fall over myself to help you more than you can help me. Now, this is very different from the type of abandonment of personal dignity that I see in many young relationships today. This is not the same thing. Young women say, oh, I'll do this. I had this abortion or I did this because my boyfriend said if I didn't, he would leave me. That's not serving the other. That is actually throwing yourself away. So it's interesting. John Paul says, no, we've got to defend the individual dignity of every single human being. And there are some things that you have to do to protect your own dignity because you're a child of God, men and women. Don't throw yourself away. Fight for your real dignity. But at the same time, our dignity is fulfilled in the giving of ourselves. And the giving of ourselves needs to be to someone who recognises our dignity. It's interesting that even in the writing of Pope Pius XI, there's a wonderful little phrase in Casti Canubi which says something like, no wife should ever do anything that is beneath her dignity. In other words, the church has always tried to defend the rights of women's dignity. Sometimes we failed because we had, you know, we made all sorts of mistakes, but that's another thing. And lastly, it's sort of, how am I going for time, Michael? Might turn it over to questions in a minute. The last thing that John Paul says, and this again goes against a lot of secular feminism. Some early feminisms claimed that the only reason that injustice occurred to women is because of men. Women were never unjust. They were always caring. From a Christian point of view, that's wrong too. because women are just, believe it or not, women, we are capable of sin. Funny about that, but we can be wrong. I know it's not often, but we can. Women, like men, need the grace of Christ and his healing. And the gospel stories that served as inspiration for John Paul II are clear that the women he meets and treats with such love and dignity, he meets them on the point of their need for his grace. Think of all those fantastic stories of the women in the Gospels. The woman at the well, the woman caught in adultery. They are liberated because they recognise that they need Christ's healing. They're some of the most colourful stories, I think, in the Gospels of recognition. Sometimes funny, the woman at the well who's asked, "So where's your husband?" And he says, "My husband. I don't have a husband." He said, "Oh, that's funny, you've got five, I thought, at last count." In other words, encountering, not by treating her like a child. The woman at the well is not treated like, "Oh, darling, anything you do that makes you happy is all right." Jesus doesn't say that to her, does he? He doesn't say, "It's okay, so you've been living with five men, that's not bad, not a bad average, if you're happy." Doesn't say that, does he? In fact, she recognises when she sees him that he's seen straight through that and that she deserves more. Very powerful encounter. So he says, John Paul says in his letter to women that the hardness of the human heart, wounded by the consequence of original sin in the passing of history, was harming and upsetting the Creator's plan for woman as well as for man. In other words, that we're made in the image and likeness of God, and that's a mission for all men and women. In other words, men and women need to work on this together. It's necessary for us to walk down the path of conversion, to return to the original vision of the law. So these are some points that maybe we can talk about at question time. I think John Paul has quite a revolutionary message. It breaks us out of this constant squabble. Who's better, men or women better? Who's more deserving of certain things? And it really gets us down to the essentials. I was going to talk about some new movements that have been inspired by this vision of Christian feminism or integral feminism. And we may not have time for that right now, but maybe in the discussion point. One person I want to... I've been doing some work with the Catholic Women's League, and if you want to read about a very inspiring woman who really does fulfil some of this new feminism is a woman called Dr. Mary Glowry, who's an Australian. She could be Australia's second saint. She was a young woman, one of the first women in Victoria to achieve a doctorate in medicine. Started one of the first groups of the Catholic Women's League to try and fight for women's working. She went on, she helped the strikers, don't know what people think of strikes, but she helped the strikers at the famous McRobinson's chocolate factory strike. And then she, in the middle of a homily at St. Patrick's Cathedral, she realised that she needed to help the women and children in India and went on to start an extraordinary hospital, the first Indian Medical Association in India, and also became a religious sister. Now that is new feminism.
You've been listening to the best of Pub Theology on credio.org.au. Pub Theology is a monthly get-together held at the Dan O'Connell Hotel in North Adelaide. 20-somethings meet up to hear engaging speakers give straight talk, hard facts and real answers on the Catholic faith. For more Catholic radio, visit our website or download our podcasts, credio.org.au. Nourishing the soul of the digital generation.